Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Kia ora and welcome along to this, our final little piece of content for Did Titanic Sink, the fantastic Radio New Zealand podcast series that I've brought you along with my friend Carlo Ritchie, who joins us now via the magic of the internet. Carlo, can you hear and see me?
Yes, hello Tim. It's very nice to be back and finally bring a close to this breaking story.
Yes, we do. There is, look, undeniably, we've got to address the elephant in the room. Real newsy vibe in here. Real newsy vibe. Carlo and I wanted to rise to the occasion of the live stream, so we're both donning suits and ties, if you're listening to the audio product only. And, I feel kind of bad about this. I'm in, like, New Zealand's premier news-making room. This is the Checkpoint studio for RNZ. Political careers have been decimated at this table. And I came in here with some hot chips and tomato sauce wearing shorts. I feel like I'm sullying the studio somehow.
Oh, it's no less an important topic, though, Tim. I mean, it goes right to the source. We've really eviscerated right to the heart of the myth of Titanic. And I think what better a studio to do it in?
Oh, that's good. That's good. Thanks for getting rid of any fears that I've got that we may be sullying the good name
also,
and spirit of this room.
It's important to know that, I mean, for all the other episodes, while we weren't wearing suits, we were wearing period costume, which was just a little something for us.
That's absolutely right. And maybe it would be good, actually, Carlo, to kick off if we pull back the curtain a little bit and give people some behind-the-scenes information. Before we do any of that, though, because I know that I'll forget to do this later and I'll feel so terrible about it, couple of things. Number one, in the lead up to this live stream, I had to listen to all the episodes back again. Pretty good show. When you're in it, when you're making it, it's very hard to, you know, get any sense of what you're making is any good. And I hadn't had the opportunity to listen back with fresh ears, but I was pretty convinced and compelled, man.
Yeah, I do. I do enjoy. I had a lot of those moments listening back to it myself, where just staring out the window and like taking a sip of whiskey and then putting it immediately down. Like, well, I'll be goddamn, those boys pulled it off.
So it would be incumbent on us, in light of that, the fact that we actually enjoyed a re-listen to the show, to say thank you so much to a couple of people who were so instrumental in bringing it together. The first person I want to mention is Justin Gregory, who is looking after the comment sections for our Facebook and YouTube respectively at the moment. He's our executive producer who looked after us throughout the entirety of the project, and just an absolute champion and a gentleman. So thank you, Justin. Do you want to say anything to Justin?
Yes, a huge thank you to Justin. And also, some of, I think, my favorite parts of the podcast were his artistic vision in saying, like, I insist that there needs to be a flashback to 1908 in this episode. And we're like, I don't know, Justin, it doesn't. Do we really need it? He's like, yes, there must be. And then listening back, He was right. The man knows radio.
Absolutely. Justin was joined by, Tim Watkin is the other executive producer. Tim's been fantastic. He's, as far as I can tell, sort of left us to our own devices, which has been great. Blair Stagpole, we've got to talk about Blair. Blair, unfortunately, he was going to operate this little operation this evening. He's been our sort of editor and studio engineer, but unfortunately he's fallen a little bit ill, so hopefully he's watching now or listening in the future. But Blair, buddy, couldn't have done it without you. The hours that you put into this, just thank you so much, mate. It was a crazy schedule.
Yeah, it was, what was it, set 2 months of editing, I think, went into these six episodes, one bonus episode.
It was nuts. And so, Carlo, should we talk a little bit about the production week? Because I think this is pretty funny. I've been telling people this sort of offline. Should we tell the story?
Yeah, sure.
as we mentioned in the podcast, you know, this all started a few years ago now at a pub in Australia where Carlo and I were swapping stories about conspiracy theories, and Carlo dropped this bombshell on me, and it stayed with me ever since. And then Radio New Zealand said, oh, we're going to do a podcast round for rangatahi, young people, for comedy. And we were like, you know what really cracks up the youth? 100-year-old maritime disaster.
So, nothing strikes through, especially if it's presented by an Australian comic.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's really going to get New Zealand's youth fired up.
100%. So we, you know, entered into it. RNZ said yes, which we were delighted by, and it really came to the party. We did a lot of, like, research, and, well, you did a lot of research, Carlo, you know, and you had written out these episode descriptions of what you wanted to do.
You watched the film.
I watched the film once, the day before we started recording, and then we got to production week. So Carlo flies over here from Canberra, and we've got a week of recording, and I'm like, I think that's enough time. We should be all right based on my experience doing this sort of thing. We record a couple of episodes in day one, and we listen back on the Tuesday, and we're like, ah, it's not quite right. Not quite. I don't quite like it. It's not quite good enough. And then we sort of did the same thing on the Tuesday from memory, and we were sort of closer, but it wasn't quite there. And then we went away on Tuesday night, and then I got viral laryngitis and couldn't talk for 2 days. And we had to record all 6 episodes
in one take.
One take, one day on the Friday, which is why we pulled in the big guns.
We really must thank, which is Chelsea, who our director, who we, on the Wednesday, we realized we really needed someone in the room just to help guide us and shape the episodes a bit. And we both worked with Chelsea before, and we're like, well, let's get her in. And she sat through us essentially bombarding her with all 6 episodes.
Yeah.
Done completely off the cuff in front of her. And she did an incredible job of keeping us to track and bringing those episodes together.
And I've got to say, Carlo, I listened back to, obviously, that final episode today, and I remember being in the room, this was only a few months ago, you managed to rattle off that last episode of assembling all the minutiae of the theory with all of the players, all of the stats, all the components, and I remember watching you do it off the cuff, and I was, like, impressed, vaguely repulsed. It was one of the most impressive feats of broadcasting I've ever seen in my life. So I can't stress to people enough, listen to that last episode, you know, if you want to engage with the series again for any reason, for a road trip maybe over the summertime, and just listen with an ear knowing that Carlo just went off the cuff reassembling the whole thing for that last ep. It was so cool.
Oh, you're very kind, Tim. You're very kind. I should stress that we had a time limit because it was about 5:15 and we lost the studio at 6.
Yes.
And that really helped, I think, knowing that we had one shot at it.
We had one go at it. Now, one other person that we have to mention is Eilish Wilson, and that was our composer for the theme song, who's a saxophonist who is based between, she's Kiwi, based between here and in America. And it was kind of a funny origin story, but I was talking to Karen O'Leary from Wellington Paranormal about a podcast, a totally different podcast, and then I started telling her about this one. She loved the concept so much, and she's like, my partner is going to go nuts when I tell her. Can I get her on the Zoom call right now just so you can talk to her? So I had a chat to her, and she was like, this sounds crazy. I go, you know, you're a musician. Would you be willing to maybe have a go at doing the theme song? And then, Carlo, do you want to talk a bit about the brief that you gave to Eilish? Well,
I think this kind of speaks to why we've come back for this epilogue, is because there are a couple of these behind-the-scenes things that we wanted to talk about with the listeners and with all the people watching it live. There's also, like, some things that we didn't get to address in the series proper, and this is a real chance. And one of them is a huge Easter egg, which I really thought somebody out there in the world other than me would pick up. But the theme music for Did Titanic Sink is actually Titanic's last distress messages. We got Eilish, like, I had, like, these long sessions with Eilish talking her through the Morse code and how it should sound. And she put together this awesome track that is, you know, the Did Titanic Sink theme music, which is Titanic's final distress call, which is CQD, ship in distress, MGY, which is Titanic's call sign, in Morse code, played on the saxophone. And it's a little Easter egg, as it turns out, just for me.
I'm so glad we've got it on the record, because it was one of those things that so much beautiful creative energy went into it, and just I needed people to know. It's too good to just go unsaid. Now, one of the big questions, as we're answering questions throughout, and by the way, if you are joining us live, thank you very much. If you're in New Zealand, please text us on 2101. Your comments and questions will be forwarded to us by Justin, and we can get to them later on in the piece. Or you can leave your comments in the comments section if you're on Facebook or YouTube. So there was some final details about the insurance component of what we talked about on the podcast, Carlo. Do you want to sort of talk us through that?
Yeah, so a lot of questions, maybe the question that came up the most from people who talked to me or messaged me about the podcast after the fact was around this insurance claim and about the fact that the money didn't really stack up. Like, why would they sink it for not the whole value or not more than the value? And it actually, it's probably worth talking about a question that Abby asked in the very last episode, which is, you know, why would they bother fitting it out with all of these amazing things and paintings and various bits of porcelain, you know, all of the fixtures if they were going to just deliberately sink it anyway, because all of that had to be handmade. And I, at the time, you know, talked about the fact that these things were years in advance in terms of being manufactured. But it was because the question came up so many times, I decided to go back and do some more research around the insurance claims about Titanic. And we talked about in the series the fact that this ship was insured for under the value of, it cost $7.5 million to make at the time, US dollars at the time, and it was insured for about $4.5 million.
So about 60% of.
Yeah, about 60% was the hull value, which it's called, which is, that's how insurance was worked out. I went back and found that Allianz Insurance, who, you know, you may have heard of them, they still exist today. They were one of the 70 insurers that covered the Titanic, the various claims that were put against the Titanic. And the total insurance paid out at the time was actually $14 million. So twice the value of the ship was the total payout of insurance.
So
they made money on this. And the reason they made money was because of all of those tiny little things like the paintings, the fixtures, all of them were separately insured to the hull value.
Which does bring the financial motive sort of more back into play. And this is a great time to bring in the very astute Dr. Abby Howells, who started probing around this question because she joins us live in the studio.
I was here the whole time.
Thank you for patiently waiting, Abby. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm lovely. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be able to make noise again because I've been I have a real hot mic.
Well, I'm so glad that you're here, and you were such a tremendous find during this podcast. Obviously, we put your full like unedited chat with Carlo as some bonus content, and I just really wanted to get you back for this as well, because you were the only person who I met on our travels who could rival Carlo's knowledge and enthusiasm for this topic. So I'm so glad you're back.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be back, and an incredible pleasure that this knowledge has come up as an adult and been useful in some capacity.
Have you been hit with any feedback yourself? Has anyone on the street asked you about your time on Did Titanic Sink at all?
Mainly about autism, to be honest with you. And someone did make a claim, but they said, I think there is a link actually between neurodiversity and the Titanic. So
yeah. I had somebody come up to me in London and say, look, I listened to Did Titanic Sink, I really loved it. Are you on the spectrum? And I said, I don't think so. And they said, because I would say that your obsession with this Titanic borders on what I describe as neurotypical. Like, it has to be beyond that in some way.
A true compliment, I think, as well.
Yeah, we've got to put that on the posters.
Yeah,
wholeheartedly agree. Absolutely. Well, we did have people bring in some questions of their own. We've had a few people sort of DM us with some commentary and some things that they wanted cleared up. Carlo, I've got a couple here to start us off, if that's cool. And Abby, you're here because you know so much about this as well, so I imagine you'll be able to help us out and throw in. One of the first ones I've got here, and unfortunately I haven't recorded their name, so sorry to who sent this in, but did they fix the Olympic? Wouldn't it have had signs of damage? Could they not just look at the Olympic to know which ship was based on that damage? Which ship was which based on that damage?
It's an excellent question, and I've had this question asked to me a couple of times as well. And the thing is, they did, they this is why I get a little bit conspiratorial. I mean, and I should point out this time as well, Tim, before I answer your question,
yes.
I should point out this, like, everything we talked about in the podcast is fact. The question of did Titanic sink, and, you know, whether the veracity of that claim was, we tested that, but everything we talked about is all true. The ship's fire, the insurance claims, the other ships, the witnesses' sightings, none of that we made up.
No, and I cannot stress this enough. Every constructed piece of radio drama that you heard is based on factual documents that Carlo sourced and put into a format for people to read. But those are court documents. Those are official documents from history.
We have to thank the Titanic Inquiry Project for going through and meticulously annotating those mostly handwritten notes and putting them into PDF savable files, which are available online. And it's an incredible read if you want to get into some light summer reading of the 2,000 pages of both inquiries.
So with that addressed, back to our core question, yes, did they fix the Olympic?
Yes. So this is where I start going a little bit more conspiratorially, because even if they didn't switch the ships, right? So the Olympic just gets fixed up and the Titanic is the ship that sank. The ship that left Belfast was completely undamaged. Like, it had been fixed up so well that there was no signs of damage. There was no listing to port or listing to starboard. There were no structural issues within the ship. And there were certainly no aesthetic differences. They were able to take the damaged panels that had been caved in by the collision with the Hawk in a previous, the very first time the Olympic went in for its initial repairs following the Hawk collision. They took the massive steel plates off the ship and replaced them completely so that it was unnoticeable. So this is the thing, is there's no visual clue from the damage of which ship is which. And it really does strike me that the fact that when the Olympic sails out of Belfast Lock and starts its next Atlantic crossing, it's like essentially brand new. It's like people comment on the fact that it's really been done to such a high level of repair that it's, you cannot tell the difference.
This isn't something I asked you in the podcast, but do you know if the public had an awareness of the incident with the Hawk? Like, was that sort of talked about? Was it newsworthy or noteworthy at all?
It was definitely reported at the time. Yeah, there's definitely in the news, but it's the same as any. It was such a minor disaster in the scheme of things, other than the fact that it involved the biggest ship in the world, which made it slightly more newsworthy. But there were no fatalities.
Yeah.
There was this huge legal battle that went on. But, you know, like, there are ship collisions all the time. They don't stay in the public consciousness for a hugely long time.
Sure.
So it was reported on at the time, but it didn't sort of stay around.
I've got another question for us here, team. If the intention was to sink it slowly and have everyone disembark, why still only have 16 lifeboats?
Well, first of all, there were 20 lifeboats. There were 16... like traditional lifeboats, and then 4 collapsible lifeboats. Is that correct? Yes.
That's right. And then yes. I think technically 2 of the what's called ship boats, which are kept uncovered and they can be used for like getting around between ships, or if somebody falls off and they need to take a boat quickly down. I can't think of what they're called, but yeah. So technically I think 22.
Good catch. Yes. Good catch, AB.
but yeah, other than that, I'll pass it off to you, Carlo. But I just wanted to be a pedant for a second.
Good. No,
it's a good question. And I mean, I guess they're referring specifically to the 16 lifeboats, which is like technically there are only 16 lifeboats plus the 4 collapsible boats plus the 2 ship's boats. But yeah, going away from that question slightly. So we talked a little bit about this in the podcast, but a year earlier, or I think maybe 18 months earlier, the Republic, which was a ship with a similar passenger capacity, still a smaller ship though, it sank, but it sank so slowly that all of its passengers were able to get off.
Right.
And the view at the time wasn't that lifeboats were for keeping people alive in the sea. They were really for taxiing people between the ships. And right. So on the Titanic, as well as, you know, a lot of those large luxury liners, they had these massive doors which were lower down on the deck, and they were used for loading passengers. So you'll remember in the film when Jack and Fabrizio win their tickets and they make the last dash to get on the Titanic, they go through this massive door quite low down on the ship. So those doors, the idea was you would lower the lifeboats, then those doors would be opened, and then passengers would be able to get off through those doors directly onto lifeboats and be transferred to other ships. And this is one of the issues of why they think Titanic sank much quicker than it should have, or started listing to one side, is crew were sent down to open those doors on the Titanic. And it's still unclear whether they were then sent to close those doors when it became apparent that the ship was sinking quite rapidly. And so there's this question about whether some of the doors were left open, which then meant that once the water reached, I think they're on E deck maybe, or D deck. Once they reached that level, water could just gush in through. When you think that the holes that did sink the Titanic were about the size of a bath towel, these were like full doors. So, you know, twice the size of all those holes. So immediately it increases the huge volume of water that's pouring in.
But back to the lifeboat question, because you're... theory was that the plan was to intentionally sink this thing slowly using a coal bunker fire so that people could safely disembark onto these other ships. So how does this answer that sort of
because if it sank over a period of like between 8 and 12 hours, then that's more than enough time for other ships to get there. Like
other ships, the Carpathia and the California, was that one of them?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep.
Get them confused in my head. They were all within the vicinity where if the ship was sinking slowly enough, they could basically just use the existing 16/20 lifeboats to ferry back and forward between these close by vessels.
Exactly. Plus whatever lifeboats that ship that's coming has. And the Carpathia also had 16 lifeboats.
Right.
So that's enough to kind of quickly move people as quickly as you need when you have a ship that's sinking very slowly.
Cool.
And this comes into that idea of who these two mystery ships were as well. Like if you're assuming that you have these two other ships out there, then even if it sinks in a shorter period of time, you kind of know that there are waiting rescue ships.
I've got a final question for this section, and just once again, if you've got some questions or comments for us and you're joining us live, you can text if you're in New Zealand 2101 or leave your comments in the comments section and we'll get to it shortly. Carlo, how do you get your credibility back now that you've told everyone Titanic didn't sink? So this was the old switcheroo that happened at the end, and Abby, we asked you about this on the episode itself, how you felt about this.
Yeah.
A little bit of betrayal.
Absolutely. Judas Iscariot, I hope you enjoy your 30 pieces of silver. I think this is, like, sitting here like a newscaster is a good way to get some credibility back, I think.
Yeah, I want to put this question entirely to Abby, actually. Yeah. How does Carlo Ritchie get his credibility back after constructing this huge house of cards with such elaborate features and rooms and hallways and then taking away one at the bottom at the very last episode? How does this man get it back?
Oh, well, there's a lot of ways you can get credibility back, I guess. One of them would be, how does one get your credibility back? I'm trying to think of, it's a redemption story.
A bigger, different conspiracy, like Double Down.
Yeah.
Or a second series really just exploring the features and details of the Titanic.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I think you've got to go down there, Carlo. I think you've got to get into the sea and prove once and for all.
So like a penance situation, like really self-flagellate using similar conditions. So basically do what Jim Cameron did to Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. If the brief behind the scenes footage from what I've seen is to be believed, that water was cold, man.
Yeah.
Even the one the actors was in was cold.
Yeah, so I've got to go and get into the Atlantic.
You do. This is like a pseudo religious sort of coming to Jesus moment.
Yeah.
I'll wash myself in those waters and be redeemed.
Pilgrimage to the middle of the North Atlantic where the Titanic sunk.
It has to be done.
Now, we had so many great stories interwoven of the characters that comprised this grander tale of Titanic. crew members. I mean, my favorite, Abby, I think, was the baker who you mentioned.
Yeah, he's great, Charles Joggin.
Just saw what was happening, decided to raid the liquor cabinet, got absolutely hammered, swam around for a little bit, didn't even get his hair wet.
Yeah, he's like, I didn't even know it was cold out there.
So good. So I wanted to open the floor because there were these two characters that we sort of touched upon a tiny bit, I think, in the podcast, but we talked about a little bit more offline, and this is obviously the space to fill in some of those gaps, of the unsinkable man and the unsinkable woman, who are these two fascinating characters associated with the event. Abby, would you be able to take the reins on this and tell us about this unsinkable woman?
Yes. Well, usually unsinkable is referred to as Molly Brown, who was like a first-class passenger.
She's in the movie.
Yeah, she's Kathy Bates in the movie.
Yeah.
But there's actually someone on board who was even more unsinkable than Molly Brown, and that was a stewardess called Violet Jessop. And Violet was born in Argentina. She became a stewardess on the seas. Initially, when she applied, she was like, hello, I'd like to be a stewardess. And they said, you are too hot for this job. And she said, I can look trash, I promise. And they said, you better. And so she went out and bought clothes and made herself look really bad, like all her, not her colors, all kinds of things. And she showed back up. She's like, may I be a stewardess now? And they were like, no, all right then. And she became a stewardess. They're quite interesting stewardesses because if there's only like, I mean, there are 900, almost 900 crew members on board the Titanic, but I think only 20, I think it's 23 were women. There weren't that many female crew members.
Right.
And most of them were stewardesses, and their job was to sort of look after the female passengers and clean their rooms and run errands and that kind of thing. So basically, it was not easy. It's not easy being in this position. And she was actually fired from her last job at the Royal Mail Line because the captain made some advances at her.
Oh.
And, well, she wrote this in her memoirs and she was like, no, not interested. And then he fired her, but for being too flirtatious. So that's
classic
how,
men, am I right?
Yeah, that's how she ended up at the White Star Line. And she didn't want to work for the White Star Line because the North Atlantic crossing was quite rough, and also they expected a really high standard of service from people, and she was like, I don't know if I'm gonna bother with that, but she got her job. But basically, first of all, she was on the Olympic when it collided with the HMS Hawk.
Oh, wow.
So she worked on the Olympic and was on board during that collision, which was like, you know, no one died, but it was probably pretty stressful.
Totally.
So she continued to work on the seas. And then, of course, she was on the Titanic when the Titanic went down. And she survived that. She made it into a lifeboat with the other stewardesses.
Wow.
And she survived again. Continued to work on the seas and then was on the third sister ship.
Come on.
Yeah, the Britannic.
Come on, when that went down. No.
So the Britannic, she became a nurse in the war, and the Britannic was hit by possibly a torpedo, or it hit a landmine and it exploded. And Violet was on that boat as well. And that one, she also did survive. She got a head fracture. This was her most traumatic one. She made it into a lifeboat, but then the lifeboat was like being sucked into the propellers of the boat.
Oh my God.
And she had to jump into the water, and she had a head injury. But she did survive.
So. I imagine that one in particular, like the fatalities must have been pretty high, right?
Actually, less than the Titanic. I think there was only like 30 deaths or something like that. But they were bad deaths. and then she continued to work on the seas for the next 30 years.
Incredible.
Yeah, but I guess after the first one you'd be like, oh no, that was stressful, and then the second one you'd be like, oh dear, surely it won't happen again.
After the third one, like, getting back on a ship, you'd have to be made of some pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, I reckon I'd be like, man, surely not.
Do you, I mean, Abby, do you, because you mentioned offhandedly, which maybe we'll get into if we've got time in this live stream, that you believe in ghosts. So you've obviously got a pretty open mind to perhaps the paranormal and things we don't observe in everyday life.
Yes.
This woman seems kind of pseudo-cursed. Like, one way of looking at it is that she was blessed because she survived all these things. But the other way to look at it is these things kept happening when she was on these ships.
Well, actually, even more stuff happened to her. She almost died of tuberculosis and scarlet fever when she was a kid. Her prognosis was so bad that they were like, oh, she's only got a few months to live. And actually, one time when she was on a ship, she went back to Buenos Aires, which is where she was. She grew up, and went back to the hospital where they told her that she was going to die and was like, look who's back, baby. It's me.
So this woman's job was just cheating death in a variety
really
of different ways.
Yeah, she really cheated death a lot.
Incredible.
Yeah.
But do you believe she was like, had some property to her, some supernatural property?
I don't know. She seems more like a Job type figure. Is he the one that was tormented by God?
Yeah.
Or Lot?
Yeah, yeah. You could be right about that.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no, so that's Violet.
Yeah.
Truly unsinkable.
Incredible. And Carlo, do you want to tell us about the man they refer to as the unsinkable man?
The unsinkable stoker, yes. John Arthur Priest, who was not only on all three of the Titanic ships. He was on the Hawk, he was on the Titanic, and he was on the Britannic. But he was also on three other ships, two that had collisions and two that sank. So he was on six ships all up that had naval disasters, four which sank, two which collided.
Wow.
And all of them before he was 30 years old.
What the heck? Yeah.
So he was a stoker, so one of the guys who shoveled coal into the boilers to keep them going, which it's even that is a crazy thing that he survived all this sinking, because usually when they had fatalities, it was the stokers and anyone that was a crewman below decks, because just the chances of getting out through the whole belly of the ship to get to the surface, to get into a lifeboat to survive, was so small, that chance. But he managed to do that six times. So the first ship he was on was called the RMS Astoria, I think, which was a collision in 1908 on its maiden voyage. Then he signed up to a beautiful ship called the RMS Olympic, and you better believe it had a collision with the Hawk. Then he decided to transfer to a more safe ship, the RMS Titanic, which also then sank. I don't know if you heard about that story, guys.
Certainly did.
And he was on the Britannic. And as Abby said, it struck a landmine and sank so rapidly. And a lot of those fatalities were people who were killed by the landmine in the belly of the ship. And he survived that, managed to get out on another lifeboat. Then he was on the HMS Alcantara, which was torpedoed and sank in 1916 during the First World War. So he then signed on to a merchant ship, being like, I'm not going to go into armed merchant ships. I'm going to go into just a normal merchant ship. So he went onto the SS Donegal, and then it got torpedoed and sank.
No way.
And after that, he was like, and interestingly, the Donegal had another Titanic survivor who was like Violet Jessop on the other three ships, but he didn't survive the sinking of the Donegal. But yeah, after that, he stopped being a stoker.
Good.
Not because he felt like it was a dangerous career, and not because he thought he was cursed, because other people didn't want to work with him anymore.
Because
they were like,
man,
that guy that's been on six ships, four of which sank. And
I'm not particularly superstitious, but if I was in the trenches with a dude, like if I'm in the coal bunker shoveling coal into this fire and we're striking up a conversation to pass the time, and he tells me he's been involved in half a dozen, like most of them fatal accidents at sea, I'd probably try and get a transfer.
Yeah, if I was out showing up to my first day of work, and he walked in, I'd be like, I would put that shovel down, and I would say, no.
Grandpa Simpson with the hat, hey, walked right back off the ship.
Going down, I'm telling you, there's something bad happening here.
I wonder if they started putting his photo up, you know, like how you have shoplifters, just like, don't hire this guy.
Yeah.
Make sure this guy doesn't turn up. That is just incredible. I guess there's some explanations around, like, if you work for White Star Line, they had a run of a few bad things that happened with particularly these Olympic class liners, but to have like half a dozen maritime disasters and survive all of them is just, in some ways it makes me a little jealous. You know, they've really lived a life, they've really done some stuff, they've gotten out there, shaken it up.
I think they actually gave him a medal for his service to the Merchant Marine for having survived so many near-death disasters at sea.
The ultimate participation award. You're still alive.
No ghost.
Trying circumstances. Right, what I want to do now is something a little bit offbeat and a little bit fun, going back in history to Abby's creative mind as, I believe, a child. Do you want to tell us about what we're going to do now, Abby?
Okay, so we're going to do a small reading of a script or a screenplay that I wrote that was highly inspired by my recent viewing of the movie The Titanic.
Yay! Yeah.
So even though I've called it a screenplay, it's very much a story with dialogue in it. It's called La Soupe Co., which doesn't mean anything. I made it up to sound romantic and fancy. Also, because my parents had recently been to see Life is Beautiful by Roberto Benigni, and they told me it had won a lot of Academy Awards. So bear in mind that I intended this to be Oscar bait. I was going for critical acclaim. So amazing. I'm going to play the role of narrator, but I was wondering if I could get the two of you to read the key roles.
Nothing would bring me more joy.
Man and woman. They don't have names. Was it an artistic choice?
You know?
Who's to say?
You don't need them to chase that Oscar. You don't need to name characters.
Oh, naming characters. Conventional.
Carlo, I'll give it to you. Do you want to be man or woman?
I'll be the woman.
Cool. I'll be man then.
Very nice. Okay, so it starts off, the first thing I've written is it's set in Spain, and that's great knowledge because it's literally never mentioned again. But do bear in mind that this entire thing is set in Spain.
It's a romantic setting.
Romantic setting. Oh, it's set just after World War II, and initially I do have the date as 1872, but that is crossed out and replaced with 1949. And do treasure that because that's the only historical research we got.
Okay.
Okay. You can see the Titanic influence here. The first line is, old man telling a story of his long-lost love on Oprah, which was Oprah. You didn't expect Oprah to be in this, but she is.
In 1940, okay. I won't interrupt, sorry.
Yeah, don't question it, Tim.
Sorry.
But this is a little bit like the old lady at the beginning of the Titanic
gotcha.
Movie.
Yes.
It was 1949, and the war was over, and I always wanted to be in the Navy. But I hated the sight of blood, and I never liked guns, and had lost a loved one on the Titanic. Very unfortunate for me to have misspelled that. But the Titanic mentioned there, an even worse nautical disaster than the Titanic, but very much brushed under history's rug. But I still wanted to be in the Navy. I went in for the training. I was practically a gold mine to the Navy since they had lost so many people in the war. So I went for the interview. First, they gave me my uniform, which I thought was a bit surprising because it was very fancy and you usually had to pay at least $200 for it. But I found out that it had belonged to one of the dead Navy captains, but I'm still very fond of it. I went to the interview. I started talking about myself and they told me to go away and never come back again after 5 minutes. After the interview, I strolled along the dock and did what most people did in this situation. Think of things to cheer yourself up. But my mind kept going back to the interview, and I cursed myself for showing them the scar on my right shoulder where a shark had bitten me on my very first fishing trip with my dad. Then I saw her. She was walking along the beach with a small dog singing. It was the most beautiful voice and person I had ever seen in my life. She was wearing a Navy uniform and singing in the Navy, by the village people, just to confirm, she is singing in the Navy by the village
Again,
people.
Very romantic.
1949, detail. Spain.
Yeah. The song was on everybody's lips. And she had on several medals, so I guess she'd probably been in the Navy. My brain at that time just went dead, and all I could think about was her. And I saw her in a wedding dress, and me in a suit next to her outside a church. And I knew that was now my goal in life, as it had been before, to not make a fool of myself. I stepped forward and forgot I was on a dock and stepped right into the water. The girl immediately used her Navy skills and ran to the edge and swam strongly to where I was and pulled me back to shore, and I lay very still so she would have to do mouth to mouth, but no such luck. She waited and I gave up and sat up pretending to be dazed. She helped me get up and then spoke.
Are you all right, mate?
I stared into her eyes and said as my first words to her,
yes, I think so.
She, to my pleasure, began to feel for broken bones, but there was none. She said,
that was quite a nasty fall you took there.
I agreed by saying,
it seemed to go on forever.
She laughed and asked again,
are you sure you're all right?
Fine,
I answered, and she walked along the beach singing again. Then I did something that made me proud years later. I called out to her and thanked her in a way that I had heard my mother say to my father when he had given her a diamond ring. She smiled and laughed. My heart broke, and I turned and started to sing and dance down the beach. End of Act One.
Tremendous.
Pretty
writing,
good.
Evie.
Thank you.
Age check again. How old were you when you wrote those?
11.
That is phenomenal.
And I left it where it is because then they go to a shop for like a really long time.
Thank you for the editorial.
It goes off the rails real fast.
For the live stream.
Yeah, there's a lot of shop talks. Oh, what are you going to get at the shop? You know, it's weird.
You got to watch these Oscar-winning stuff. Some of them are like fantastic writers. And then they go on to form an unhealthy obsession about the Titanic and Landers gets on podcasts and open up a whole new world. Mm. But this is quality stuff. This could go somewhere.
It's not that bad, eh?
I don't know if like this draft would be the Oscar-winning one, but the bones are good.
Yeah, it's very much the first draft, but there's something there,
absolutely.
I feel like.
Yeah. And quite, I would say, like, very creative. It would never occur to me as an 11-year-old doing creative writing to write something in the first person of a gender that I'm not. That's
yeah,
really
it's an interesting choice, eh? The Iron Man. I guess I'd really seen the Oscar movies and have been like, well, you know, Roberto Benigni was a man, you know, everybody, you got to have the female-driven movies that's just not given the same audiences.
Got it. So this is actually like...
me catering to the
internalized, internalized misogyny, effectively.
Yeah.
You saw Hollywood, you're like, okay, I get it. I know what I have to do. I have to be a man.
Yeah. Got to be man.
Well, great writing nonetheless.
Thank you.
Okay, a couple more questions now. And sorry, Carlo, unless you want to give any feedback on our Oscar impending script.
No, I mean, I would suggest that potentially something that's worth changing for the Oscar winning version is to set it in a country that didn't remain neutral in the Second World War. But... admittedly, that war could be the Spanish Civil War, which I may have had a naval part in.
We have had a text message, and if you are joining us in New Zealand on the live broadcast, 2101 is the text number, or you can just send us stuff in the comment section. Jack from Wilton has asked, how many Inter-Islanders would fit into the Titanic? Carlo, I don't even know if you'd be familiar with the Inter-Islander, but it's the ferry that goes between the North and South Island across the Cook Strait. I've just done...
How many of those would fit into the Titanic?
Yeah, yeah.
How big is the Inter-Islander?
The only thing I can find immediately to hand, and I can dig in a little bit, is that it is 220 metres long. Do you remember
how
long
the Titanic... That's quite
big. Yeah, it's long. How long's the Titanic? Do you remember?
Oh, that's an excellent question from memory. Is it 709 metres?
That sounds right. Yes, I have the image of the newspaper where they put it up like this against like modern skyscrapers.
You guys are way off, according to what I'm seeing on the internet. Oh. 269 metres?
269
metres? Yeah. Does that track?
Wow.
Does that
commit? It might be 709 feet.
Oh, yeah, that might be it, yeah. Which means the Inter-Islander is about
90%. It's about the size of the Titanic. Yeah.
So, one.
Yeah, so, Jack, to answer your question, I assume in every other dimension it's probably quite different, but lengthwise, you're only getting one of those in there, mate.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because when you look at the Titanic, most modern cargo ships are bigger than the Titanic was.
Modern cargo ships are crazy, though.
Yeah, but I mean, just in terms of scale, like it's not a huge ship by any mean feat. You know, it's even like modern cruise ships dwarf the Titanic
by modern standards.
Yeah, it's not a huge ship.
Okay, I've got some more questions here from people joining us. Abby, I want to throw this one to you first. Did the movie, that I assume this is the James Cameron movie, because I recently found out there's three, I think, Titanic movies?
Yeah, there was one made in the 50s, I believe.
57?
A Night to Remember was one. They made one based on an autobiography, I think, as well. Yeah.
And then Jim Cameron's one.
Yeah.
I'm assuming this question is about the recent one, the 1997 James Cameron one. Did the film get anything outrageously incorrect?
I think the major thing that I think of, I don't know about you, Carlo, is that Jack was like invited into the first class dining lounge to like have dinner. And I don't think that ever would have happened. Like that, the classes were so incredibly segregated. I don't think they ever would have happened that they would have allowed a steerage passenger into first class, even if he was hot and scrubbed up nice.
You're going to have bouncers between like in first class. I guess the staff are kind of maintaining, you know, the separation or segregation between the classes.
Yeah. Right? Oh, there was this one guy there. I can't remember his name, but he was a little bit of a con artist and he came in second class and then put on heaps of jewels and then strutted around pretending he was first class.
That rocks.
Yeah.
Love
that. That's the one that I think of. But what about you, Carlo?
I think probably the big one is like all of the paintings that Kate has. You know, like she has Picasso and a Keith, I think, and a Monet painting, like all these like extraordinarily famous available works, which is a very odd thing to put in a film where you know the ship is going to sink. You know, like, that always sort of, that's always an interesting one. The other thing is, like, the big one is the Titanic stops after they hit the iceberg, which didn't happen in real life. So in real life, it stopped like immediately after the iceberg, but then Captain Smith ordered it back up. He's like, let's just run for a little bit longer and see how it's going, which is also one of the reasons why it sank much faster, because the water was suddenly pouring in.
That would make things far worse, right? Like taking on water if you're moving through the ocean at that point.
Exactly. And that kind of goes to the claim of them trying to get closer to other ships. So in this case, maybe trying to get closer to the Californian for rescue or to the position where they thought other ships were, like the SS Parisian, for example.
Right. And I'll add a detail which, Carlo, correct me if I've got the details wrong, but having just re-listened to the podcast, what you believe, well, the American version of Bruce Ismay was a very villain-coloured sort of caricature of him that was...
Oh, yeah.
Continued on in the film, as it's been, you think he was sort of unfairly recorded in history and James Cameron continued that tradition in the film.
Totally. And I think they do that for all of the British characters, really. Like, there's a very much an American, like, you know, an anti-British feeling throughout the film, which I can certainly understand. But, you know, like, there's just constantly, like, officers coming into deck drinking tea in the emergency, like, what's going on in here? You know, and then, like, evil. Like, there's constant... Almost every officer is shown at some point holding a cup of tea at one point, just, like, to really visually establish that they're English, you know?
Okay. Well, this brings us to a very special part of the live stream and something that I've probably had as the big ticket item in my head going into this. As I mentioned at the top, Dr. Abby House was an incredible find through the journey of us bringing on comedic guests to join us and reflect back to us if Carlo had gone on insane, if he was dragging me into his insanity, and striking upon a person in the New Zealand comedy community who was going toe for toe with Carlo on Titanic Facts was a revelation. And so what I wanted to do during this this live stream, this final sort of full stop on the series, is to pit you two against each other to try and determine one Titanic champion by having a 5-question quiz to see who really knows the most about the Titanic.
I already feel a certain degree of trepidation given that I just thought the Titanic was nearly a kilometre long.
I also just preface, me and Carlo have been so nervous about this quiz that every email we've had about this have been like, oh God, my credibility.
All of the credibility of this podcast could go out of the way. I'm trying to restore this thing. You know, like before I did this podcast, I was only 1% invested in this conspiracy. Now I'm like 25% in belief of it. I desperately need to get my credibility back, and instead I'm going to do a quiz and just absolutely fall.
You're looking at this all wrong. Much like the Titanic, we are fully invested against loss here, because one of the two major participants on the podcast is going to win, so that will go some way to restoring credibility in the series itself.
My heart is beating. I also have a real tendency to absolutely lose it in a quiz situation.
Well, there's only two of you, so let's find out how you do, Abby. Take a breath. Do you want to take a drink of water while I present our first question? We'll use the honor system a little bit here, folks. Carlo, you're on an internet connection, but it's pretty quick. So I'm just going to get you to buzz in with your names if you want to go first, okay, on the question. So here's the first question. You can't see my screen, Abby?
No.
Okay, great. First question. I feel a little embarrassed asking it now because it's come up earlier in the episode. What was Titanic's gross registered tonnage, aka her carrying capacity, to the nearest metric ton?
I think I know this, but I
absolutely do not know it.
I think I do know it, but I might be thinking of its displacement, which is not too dissimilar, but then I might get it completely wrong. I have a feeling... Oh, God, am I going to double? I have a feeling it's 22,000 and something tons, but now there's like this thing at the back of my mind saying it's 41,000, but I think it's 20... Is it 22,000?
What do you... You tell me what you want to lock in.
I think... It's something around 22,000 tons, I think.
I'm locking you in for 22,000. Abby, what is your guess?
Oh, gosh. My hands are shaking. This is terrifying. Okay, I'm going to go with Carlo overshooting again. And I'm going to go as 15,000 tons.
Carlo is closest, but other Carlo was more closer. So it's, the correct answer is 46,329.
Oh, no.
I second guessed myself. I was like, no, I think you're overshooting, Carlo. You gotta damn ferry.
You do need to calm down a little bit here. You're self-flagellating like you're getting these obvious facts wrong. No one knows the stuff off the top of their head. Please calm
down.
Our worst
fears are coming true with the first question, Tim.
Okay, this one's not a math one, it's a person one.
Okay.
Who was Titanic's most wealthy passenger?
Abby.
Go.
John Jacob Astor.
Carlo, do you want to take a guess?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's John Jacob Astor the fourth as well.
Abby gets the point because she got there first. You're both correct. Well
the
done.
The real winner is knowledge.
That's it. See, you
thank
you.
Yeah, I'm all good. Yeah, I don't lose completely my credibility. I haven't Carloed myself.
What do you... you cannot establish that as a verb. Abby, do you know about this cat? John Jacob Astor the fourth. His name is my name too.
Yes, yeah. He died on the ship. He was one of the I can't remember, but I believe he changed into a tuxedo to go down with
the
ship.
Oh, was he one of those guys? There was a
and
few
sort
guys
of
who
went
that,
down
eh?
Like gentlemen. I think it was Guggenheim who put a flower in his lapel and said, "Go down like gentlemen, boys."
Go down like gentlemen.
Yeah, but I know he was one of the most wealthy people on the ship. And was quite stoic.
Am I right, Abby? Was he traveling with his mistress and she survived?
Yes. Yeah.
Go here.
And I think his mistress was pregnant, maybe, with like a...
Yes. He was outrunning a scandal, I think.
Yes, a scandal child.
His,
yeah.
That is scandalous.
Her name
was
Madeline? No, that's his wife. Madeline Astor? I don't know.
I wrote some of these details down. The others I'm going by memory. But I believe he was the heir of a wood pulp fortune. From the Astor family.
Nice.
Apparently he was by far the richest individual on Titanic. He was worth an estimated, by today's money in USD, $2 billion,
wow,
adjusted for inflation. $2 billion US dollars is what he was worth. Okay, so right now you're both on one apiece. We will now go to our third question.
You're great. You're giving me other Carlo's answer as a point?
The one you locked in was closer than Abby, so you get for it because she went down to 15,000, you see. Okay, question of the third. There were 706 third-class passengers on Titanic. My question is, how many bathtubs were available for them to bathe in?
Abby.
Carlo.
Oh, it's close. I'm going to give it to Abby. I think she got there just a tiny
bit quicker. That's fine.
Two. Yep.
Carlo?
One.
Abby is correct. It was two.
Well done, Abby.
Oh, I had to... Thank you. I'm overwhelmed. I'm so excited. Oh, thank you.
You haven't won yet.
I've been flipping. I know, but I just gotten some correct, and I was so scared I was going to come out here and just really flip out as I do in a quiz situation.
Yeah, you can lose now and with respect.
Hold my head up high after this. It's just all you want in life.
So two bathtubs between over 700 people sounds pretty crazy, but I was sort of digging into this a little bit, and apparently not as crazy for the time as it sounds. Even in because they're the steerage passengers, is that right? Mm-hmm. Third class? So they're like the lowest who were on board, is that correct?
In position of the ship?
Yeah, it was sort of a steam and their quarters and that kind of thing.
They would have been the cheapest tickets. Yeah.
between six and eight pounds to get on the ship at the time. And they all did have suites with a basin. And apparently, like, the standards of the Titanic, even for these lower class passengers, far exceeded any other ship. So it was quite luxurious for the time for passengers, even in third class.
Yeah, they had hot water in their basins, which they a lot of them wouldn't have had at home.
Yeah, I did. I read, and electricity as well. Yeah. Like, a lot of these people at the time wouldn't have had electricity in their houses, and they did on the ship in their rooms. So crazy to think how much luxury we've got these days, you know? We're all living like pharaohs. Like Egyptian pharaohs, and we just complain about everything. Anyway, fourth question for the quiz, folks. How many dogs survived the Titanic?
Abby.
Carlo? Abby?
One.
Carlo?
I also thought it was one, but I'm just, for interest's sake, because Abby mentioned in the podcast, like, this dog, little Pomeranian dog, surviving on someone's lap. And I had this feeling there was a dog also pulled out of the water. So I'm just going to, for interest's sake, say two.
Carlo, you're correct.
Oh,
there was a Pomeranian and a Pekingese.
There you go.
You're getting your credibility back, Carlo.
So just to let you folks know, we're on the fifth question now, and you're both 2 points apiece.
Oh, gosh. Oh.
The stakes could not possibly be higher.
This is the biggest thing.
Oh, goodness me.
If you're just tuning in at this point, welcome to the live stream. We are about to determine who is the most knowledgeable on the Titanic out of Carlo and Abby.
Definitively.
It comes down to this. Okay. How many officers were tasked with updating the clocks aboard Titanic as they passed into different time zones?
Oh.
I don't know.
I
have to be a guess.
I'm going to just guess as well. I'm going to just guess.
I'm going to guess.
Oh, will someone say their name? Someone say their name to buzz in. Rules are rules.
Oh, Carlo?
Carlo.
I'm going to guess one.
And keep going.
I thought when you were saying you have to say their name, I was like, and I think it's going to be Pittman.
Please name all of the crew who updated the clocks. Okay, so your answer is one. You're locking that in.
I feel bad about it. I'm going to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But, I'm just going to have to go with one.
And to Abby now.
You know what? I'm going to go with three.
Okay.
Abby.
Thank you. The correct answer is one.
Oh,
Carlo.
Was it Pittman?
You've done, huh?
Was it Pittman?
It was the captain. So, interestingly, the Titanic had a system where all of the clocks aboard were synced to the master clock, so the captain could update it, and all of them in real time would update along with it. So there was no manual changing of the clocks apart from that single one in the captain's area.
That is incredible. I did not know that.
I didn't know that. My sincerest congratulations to you, Carlo.
You're well done, Carlo.
Well done.
It was a guess, though.
I'd just like to congratulate myself, because all these other questions, I think you guys could have, like, you know, guessed ahead of time, done some research, but I really wanted to get some curly one for the end one. I did a lot of research last night to try and figure some weird stuff out that you guys wouldn't know.
I was so sure I was going to be what was the final song that played as the band went down.
Am I right in saying that's not known, though?
Yeah, I mean, they say it's like Nearer God to Thee, but it was actually a waltz called the Autumn
Waltz.
Yeah.
And there's also somebody who claimed that it was Alexander's ragtime band.
Look, we are fast running out of time for this live stream. We've got 2 minutes left. And Abby, I wanted to open the floor to you. First of all, I don't mean to skip over it. Carlo, congratulations on your win.
What a
great 3-2 victory. Couldn't have scripted it better, but well done for coming out on top there.
Credibility back, confirmed.
Indeed. Abby, do you think we've got time? There was a delightful story that you started telling me the other day about a tale of marriage woe about the Carters that I thought we could end on.
They really proved that. You really bring yourself wherever you go. But basically, they were two first-class passengers, the Carters, and they, when the Titanic hit the, William and Lucille Carter were their names, and the Titanic hit the iceberg, and Lucille was in the cabin with her, their two children, and William was still up kind of smoking, and he came down to the cabin and said, you should probably get dressed and head up there. And Lucille was like, okay. And then, like, picked the, you know, got the children all ready, went through the ordeal of, you know, getting into a life raft and all that stressful stuff. And she did not see William again until her lifeboat arrived at the Carpathia and he was leaning against the rails, just kind of like, hello, great to see you. And she came up, you know, up the lake with her two small children. And, like, and he said, it's a good breakfast here. And she said, what? And then he said, I bet you didn't expect to see me. And then just less than a year later, she did file for divorce. And she cited the way her husband acted in that moment on the Titanic as one of the primary reasons. And that divorce was granted.
Wow. So one more casualty of the Titanic was the Carter's marriage.
Yeah.
Just goes to show, even if you, like, bring yourself on the most luxurious ship imaginable to try and get away from yourself and restart your relationship, you can't escape yourself, can you?
A nautical disaster will not save your marriage.
I mean, hope everybody's taking heed to that. Well, look, to close off, I'd just like to thank so much the team that's been around us at RNZ to get this series made. It's been tremendous working on it. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Abby, for everything you've brought to the podcast. And Carlo, man, it's been so fun to work with you on this and so impressive to watch you just, I don't know, the storytelling, the research, the broadcasting chops. It's been a delight being at your side for this. So congratulations.
It's been a real pleasure. I'm so glad we finally got to work together on something, you know, and just you ask all the right questions. You have such a keen, discerning eye, and it was a real pleasure to divulge into this mystery with you.
Thank you very much. Well, with that, we will bid everyone a bon voyage. One other question that's been coming through a lot is there a season two? Not that I know of, but balls in your court, Radio New Zealand. Until then, ka kite anō.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.